I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. 50 years ago, the North Vietnamese military was planning the Tet Offensive, a New Year's Eve surprise assault on strategic cities and sites in South Vietnam. One of their targets was the city of Hue that had been largely untouched by the war. That changed on January 31, 1968, when the North Vietnamese Army and Viet Cong guerrillas attacked the city, catching the residents and the U.S. troops stationed there unaware. Mark Bowden's book, Hue 1968, is a moment-by-moment account of the 24-day battle based on interviews with combatants on both sides of the fighting and research into the archives of the war. It's about the chaos of urban warfare, also about the blunders and lies by military and political leaders that resulted in needless deaths and the American public turning eventually against the war. Mark Bowden is a national correspondent for The Atlantic, contributing editor for Vanity Fair, and joins us once again on Radio Times to talk about yet another one of his books. Mark Bowden, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
What were you doing in 1968?
1968, I was a sophomore in high school, and I was playing baseball and basketball and on the soccer team and having drag out arguments with my dad over the Vietnam War.
Like a lot of teenagers at that time.
Yeah. You know, my dad, who was a smart guy and college educated, he would always say, "How do you know that?" Or, "Where did you read that?" And he made me, that prompted me actually to begin reading newspapers. I remember when I was still in high school, I subscribed to Time magazine myself and started reading it cover to cover. And when my mom would take me to the library, where I was used to just sort of grabbing books at random, I started reading more selectively in order to prepare myself for these battles with my dad. And I think, you know, frankly, looking back on it, it is one of the things that led me into a career in writing and journalism.
Well, let's talk about the Vietnam War, and we're talking 1968. The war had been going on for a number of years at that point, from, I guess, 64 to 68, going from advisors to something like 500,000 troops. How was the war going from the American perspective?
Well, the Americans, you know, I think had made a substantial impact. The best way to describe it is that the war was kind of at a stalemate. Hanoi was being hammered by bombs from the air. They were nevertheless still able to infiltrate their army forces down through the Ho Chi Minh Trail into South Vietnam. And the Viet Cong, which was the South Vietnamese guerrilla movement, had a substantial amount of popularity, and particularly in the rural population. But for the most part, up until, you know, the beginning of 1968, the war was being fought in the hills and in the jungles, and there was a sense in the cities of South Vietnam that the United States had the situation under control.
We talked today about asymmetrical warfare. I mean, it seems, looking at the Vietnam War, especially with the Viet Cong and the kind of guerrillas against this large and very expensive U.S. military.
Mm-hmm. Well, the United States military was extremely good at fighting any enemy force that they encountered. And so the premier strategy of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong was hit and run. And so you talk to all these guys that I talked to who fought there, and it was a terribly dangerous and frustrating experience to be fighting in Vietnam, because you would go, you know, you'd be wrestling with boredom essentially in days and days of hiking, and then all of a sudden, in a flash, you know, there would be an encounter, and then before they had time to really mass any significant amount of force to respond, the enemy would melt away.
What did the North Vietnamese, what did they hope to accomplish from the Tet Offensive?
Well, this was their big push, and they believed that if they managed to launch attacks in the cities, which was would have been and was a huge surprise, that the people of South Vietnam, the urbanites, would welcome them, as we've heard this story before, as liberators, and would rise up and unite with them against the South Vietnamese forces and the Americans. And many, I mean, including the top leadership of the party in Hanoi, believed that the Tet Offensive would end the war, that it would chase the Americans out and topple the Saigon regime.
You describe North Vietnamese, not civilians, but just sort of regular people on the Ho Chi Minh Trail carrying arms carrying animals, mm-hmm. all sorts of things in secret, unknown to the Americans, yeah. down this trail in order to prepare for this test.
Yeah, it is one of the most extraordinary features of this battle that the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong were able to amass 10,000 troops outside the city of Hue without the American or South Vietnamese forces even knowing it. And the process by which they did it was really quite dramatic. As you said, Marty, it was, you know, a lot of these guys pressed into service in the North Vietnamese Army were math teachers and, you know, laborers or farmers. And here they were carrying 40, 50-pound packs, marching up and down the very difficult mountainous trail, getting bombed by napalm and, you know, occasionally being hit by American forces, but using their ingenuity. And, for instance, you mentioned carrying animals. You know, Americans carried sea rations. The Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese carried pigs, and they would drug them so that they didn't make any noise, but they would carry them along until they would slaughter them and cook them, and, you know, that's how they ate.
The first person we actually meet in your book is a woman from the north who worked as a spy. I'm going to mispronounce her name.
Che Te Mung.
Who was she?
Che was an 18-year-old village girl, actually, just who lived in the outskirts of Hue, which is in South Vietnam. And she and her family had been fighting for the independence of Vietnam for generations. Her grandfather and her father had fought against the Viet Minh, which fought against the French and kicked them out. And then her father and her older sister had fought with the Viet Cong. Her older sister had been captured and killed by the South Vietnamese Army. And Che herself, when she was just 16, had been arrested after her sister was killed because suspicion fell on her family, and had been tortured, waterboarded. And when I met her, you know, in Hue, she's about my age, a couple years older, you know, remains intensely proud of the fact that she mm-hmm. never gave up any information under interrogation. So Che was recruited to be part of this force of village girls who were not suspicious, you know, at all, to spy on the Americans and the South Vietnamese troops in the city of Hue.
What did she see?
Well, she was moving around the city selling, like, conical hats, which she would carry on a bicycle, and she would set up on the sidewalk outside of, say, the American compound in Southern Hue, and she would see the numbers of Americans coming and going, the kind of weapons that they had, the where the guard posts were, when the guards changed shifts. She did the same at various South Vietnamese Army outposts, and every evening, she would report back. She didn't take notes because that would have been too dangerous, but she memorized numbers and movements and came back. And over a period of time, you know, her superiors were able to plot a fairly sophisticated mm-hmm. map of the comings and goings and the capabilities of these various outposts.
What was the U.S. military doing in Hue?
Mostly in Hue, there were American advisors. So it was not a heavy American military post. It was mostly there were South Vietnamese troops there. So the Americans who were there were attached to units as military advisors. The situation changed a little bit over the Tet holidays because this is the biggest holiday of the year, the Lunar New Year in Vietnam, and the South Vietnamese forces were given furloughs. And they would go home and spend days with their families. So the Americans attached to those units all sort of gathered at what was called the MACV, it's Military Advisory Command Vietnam compound in southern Hue, to just sort of hang out with their American buddies and barbecue and party. And they were anticipating a kind of a break for 4 or 5 days.
And how long did it take for the North Vietnamese, and I'm assuming with Viet Cong guerrillas, how long did it take them to take the city of Hue?
They took it in about 4 or 5 hours, overnight, January 31st, 1968. This, you know, incredibly large force, estimated 10,000, just descended on the city. And other than a few firefights at the gates of the Citadel, which is the big fortress that is, in fact, Northern Hue, at those gates, there were still kind of skeletal South Vietnamese troops. And so there were firefights at a few of those gates. But other than that, they marched into the city and they took it. The American compound found itself surrounded, and they fought, you know, all through the night to try to just prevent themselves from being overrun.
And this was part of this Tet offensive. Saigon was attacked. Other cities were attacked as well.
Right. More than 100 cities, towns, villages, all the major urban centers in South Vietnam were hit at once. Wow. Saigon, you know, the raiding force managed to penetrate into the grounds of the American embassy, and there was a big firefight there. And even though the offensive in Saigon was very much smaller than the one in Hue, that was where most foreign American reporters were located. So the emphasis of the reporting around the Tet Offensive focused primarily on these battles going on in Saigon, when in fact Hue was far and away the major achievement of the Tet Offensive, and they basically had completely occupied the city within hours.
In fact, you say it was the bloodiest, most violent battle of the Vietnam War.
Without question, yeah. It took 24 days for the Marines and for the 1st Cav to basically wrest the city back from the enemy, and many hundreds of, 250 American soldiers were killed, thousands wounded, easily 5,000 to 10,000 civilians killed, many, many North Vietnamese, Viet Cong. It was, you know, I estimate very conservatively 10,000 people killed, which would make this far and away the biggest, bloodiest battle of the Vietnam War.
Well, this book is about many things, but one is this, what is the word, disconnect between the U.S. military on the ground, who saw what was going on, and General Westmoreland and other military leaders as well. What did they think was going on in Hue?
Well, General Westmoreland assured the president and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the American public that nothing had happened in Hue, that there may have been a few hundred enemy soldiers who were still in the city, but that the Marines were in the process of wiping them out. And essentially, that kind of described what had happened in Saigon. It was completely false about what was going on in Hue. And in fact, you know, Westmoreland and President Johnson had a CIA report on the day that the city was taken, which told them, you know, this city is now in the hands of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. And there are only these two very embattled little outposts, one American and one South Vietnamese army, who are hanging on for dear life.
We're almost up on a break here. Is this the fog of war, or was it something? Is it more pernicious than that?
I think it's a little more pernicious than that. I think there were certainly people like that CIA report and like the military advisors in Hue who knew exactly what had happened and were reporting it. But, you know, General Westmoreland is not the first commander who only heard information that he wanted to hear. And so he persisted in his denials that this hadn't happened.
That is Mark Bowden, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called Hue, 1968. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic, also contributing editor for Vanity Fair. And we are marching through, if I can say, this moment-by-moment battle, a very important battle, and largely forgotten battle in the Vietnam War, the Battle of Hue. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Mark Bowden about his new book, Hue 1968. He says the bloodiest battle of the Vietnam War, resulting in the deaths of something like 10,000 North Vietnamese soldiers, Viet Cong guerrillas, U.S. troops, and local civilians, part of the surprise Tet Offensive in 1968. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. So this is this surprise attack on 100 cities, essentially, by the North Vietnamese, and also with Westmoreland and other leaders essentially dismissing what they are hearing from their own military leaders on the ground in Hue. Why do you think the U.S. didn't anticipate this, or didn't maybe even respect what it was that we were hearing?
Well, I think, you know, General Westmoreland was a kind of a prototype for a certain kind of command error. But he was very wedded to his highly complex, very well thought out theory of what was happening. And in his theory, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong were too weak to mount attacks in force, and they could only really attack American and South Vietnamese troops on the outskirts of the country in the far regions like the mountains, or which is why he anticipated this huge attack at Khe San, which was on a hilltop near the Laotian border. The idea that they could somehow infiltrate all these troops and attack cities just did not compute with General Westmoreland. And so to the extent that when it actually happened, you know, he refused to believe that it had happened.
Is that a combination of ignorance and arrogance, perhaps?
I think that's a good guess. You know, he was convinced of his rightness, and not even the desperate, communications from these young Marine officers and Army officers in the field could dissuade him of his opinion. Mm-hmm. In fact, these, you know, younger leaders on the ground were dismissed as panicky, you know, cowardly, timid, which are all just, you know, damning adjectives in the military.
In fact, let me have you read a section from the book. And this is very early February. So the attack, in a way, is January 31st. This is early February. Right. Might need a little setup, but
sure, you know,
takes us there.
The big thing, the big fighting, most of it took place inside of the Citadel, which is North Hue and in the city. But the Army was tasked with moving toward the Citadel on the outside, basically cutting off the Viet Cong avenue of escape and also avenues for supply. The battalion in the field, which was the 2nd of the 12th of the 1st Cav, was ordered to attack. What they could see was an overwhelming enemy force in an open field outside an area called La Chu. So the battalion commander, Dick Sweet, is on the radio saying, trying to talk his commanders out of ordering this frontal attack, and he hears, and I'll pick up reading right now, "You will attack now," this is General Campbell, told Sweet. Then, using his call sign, he said abruptly, "War Master, out." There would be no further discussion. The men around Sweet heard him say, "Roger, out," and knew what was coming. Captain Helvey thought, "If it's possible, we'll do it. If it's not possible, the charge will be remembered for a long time and celebrated in the annals of the regiment." The time to move was now, while the Hueys were still overhead. Sweet ordered his men to prepare to charge the woods. Captain Crone fought the urge to empty his bladder. He chambered rounds in both his rifle and his pistol. When the order came, he would stand and start running with everyone else. "Move out," Sweet ordered. "Let's go," came the cry. 400 men rose and began running forward. There were too many for the enemy to shoot at once, but many were cut down as soon as they stood. There was no choice but to keep going. Some stopped to pull others up or drag or carry them. These were seasoned soldiers, and there was no panic. Gonzalez fired his rifle in 3-round bursts as he ran. Dentinger ran and prayed. DeLeo, with that heavy mortar plate on his back, felt as if he were running in slow motion. He assumed he'd get hit. He had spent nearly every day of his months in Vietnam in the field. He was pretty good at math, and given all the death and maiming he'd seen, he'd long ago figured that his chance of getting out of Nam alive or without a serious wound was near zero. Paralyzing fear had eroded to grim acceptance. Moments like this drove it home. This was the deal. He ran. He tried to zigzag, and he collided with the man next to him. They went down heavily. DeLeo felt as if he'd been chopped block on a football field. He got up and resumed running. His immediate hope was that he would be killed cleanly and quickly.
Such a chilling description. Again, the sort of image of 400, these are Marines, right? 400.
No, these are actually Army troopers from the 1st Cav Division.
Gotcha. And running across a field not knowing, am I going to get hit?
Right.
Is my buddy going to get hit?
Or assuming I'm going to get hit.
Or assuming.
I mean, they knew that the force shooting at them was much better positioned, much better armed, and the chances of them making it were small.
Was there any point to this exercise?
As it turned out, no. They were being sent against a force which turned out to be thousands of enemy soldiers. And it took losing half of this company, or battalion rather, half of this battalion, before the army commanders realized that the North Vietnamese were there in huge numbers and that it was suicidal to keep throwing these men against them.
There were, what, about 140,000 people living in Hue at the time?
Right.
The civilian population?
Right.
So the North Vietnamese military comes in, essentially occupies, takes over the city, expecting people to rise up and greet them as liberators.
Right.
Did that happen?
It did not. I mean, some people did, but the vast majority of people in Hue fled or dug in bunkers under their houses if they couldn't get away. They began, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong began setting up their own liberation government, and they began hunting down civilians who had been working for or were associated with the South Vietnamese, the Saigon regime, and rounding them up and marching them off. Ultimately, we learned most of them were executed.
Mass graves, right?
They found mass graves. You know, it's difficult because so many people were killed in crossfire and bombing. So many were executed. Figuring out in months later as they unearthed these mass graves, how many had been killed in what way became, you know, virtually impossible. But a very large number of citizens, civilians were executed. And really, the citizens of the city had nowhere to go. They feared the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese. They feared the American guns. And they, you know, in some cases, for instance, in the Citadel, there are only 9 ways in and out. So there was no way out. They had basically to dig in and pray.
Well, eventually a captain or I guess colonel or captain?
Lieutenant colonel.
Lieutenant colonel Cheatham.
Ernie Cheatham. Yeah.
Ernie Cheatham comes to Hue to essentially figure out how to deal with the North Vietnamese that had taken over using, as you say, urban warfare borrowed in many ways from the Korean War. Here's a clip where Cheatham is talking about these civilians, some of whom you just described, who got caught in the battle. Let's give it a listen.
What's going to happen to civilians who might get caught in there?
Well, we're hoping that we don't run into any civilians in there right now. If they are, I'm pretty sure there are civilians that are what we would consider the bad guys right now. We have certain areas in here that we have blocked off, that we know there are friendly civilians, and we aren't going to take those under fire.
The others?
The others, if there's somebody in there right now, they're Charlie as far as we're concerned.
And he's talking to Jack Lawrence there.
Of CBS.
We certainly talk about civilians now. Civilians are casualties of war. Was there any special concern for civilians?
I found very little. In fact, that clip of Jack Lawrence asking that question is about the only time I know of where it came up. And I read a lot of the news coverage, the magazine coverage, and looked at a lot of the film footage shot. And generally speaking, the Army, South Vietnamese Army and American Army, were far more concerned with preserving historic buildings in Hue than they were about preserving the lives of civilians. And as I said, in this case, it's a densely populated city, the third largest city in South Vietnam. And, you know, these folks had nowhere to go. And they wound up, many of them, sort of wandering the streets in huge numbers, trying to avoid, you know, the outbreaks of gunfire. And where Cheatham there refers to areas that they've marked out, that means that 2 blocks behind him, the 2 blocks that they had already managed to take back, they had established a kind of a refugee center. So if people made it there, they were relatively safe as long as the Americans continued to advance. And so they weren't shooting at them deliberately, but the idea that if they're in these 9 blocks in front of me, their Charlie showed the fact that Cheatham had never been to Hue before. He didn't really understand the city and didn't understand the dynamic.
And that is Mark Bowden. We are talking about Hue, and his new book is titled Hue 1968, a moment-by-moment account of the battle for the city, both taken over by the North Vietnamese and then the U.S. Fighting back. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. We hear Jack Lawrence there, one of your former bosses. Gene Roberts was also in Vietnam. In fact, he was one of the first reporters to go to Hue. Did he report on the battle directly, Gene Roberts?
He did. He was the first reporter to get there because he had actually flown to Da Nang thinking that this is one of the places hit during the Tet Offensive, and it turned out that the incident at Da Nang was relatively minor. But the troops there told him, well, actually, something really big is happening in Hue. So he flew in on one of the first helicopters of Marines, and he had heard the official pronouncement that there was nothing really big had happened in Hue. There were a few hundred enemy soldiers there. And yet inside that military compound in southern Hue, he could see the efforts that the Marines were making to fight their way one block out in any direction and being turned back. And it dawned on Gene, you know, these troops are surrounded and outnumbered, and the city is basically owned by the enemy. He managed to get out on another helicopter and file his story. So in, I think it was the Saturday, February 3rd, which was 2 days later, after two or three days of official denials, the New York Times had a front page story that said the truth, which is the city is now owned by the enemy and the Marines there are outnumbered and trapped.
I was watching several videos of this battle and also got me looking at videos from the Vietnam War. And what is so striking is just how close these reporters were to the fighting, what they sort of standing on street corners or standing in fields and reporting what's happening around them.
Yeah.
It's pretty extraordinary.
Well, and it's one of the ironies of the Vietnam War, probably was the war where journalists were given the most free access to combat. You could essentially in Vietnam go anywhere where there was fighting if you could arrange military transport, and generally you were allowed. And, you know, many cases later, the military felt that this had backfired because what happened was reporters would tell stories of the people who were actually doing the fighting. And when that contradicted the official story, that became embarrassing for the administration.
What's interesting is Walter Cronkite, I guess, getting wind of the sense that things were not going well in Vietnam, goes over there, right. I guess, in part on what had happened in Hue.
Sure. I mean, he was the anchorman on CBS, and he had supported the war. And for the years prior to 1968, had essentially been reading reports to, and he had a huge slice of the American audience, essentially reporting the official position. When Tet happened, and he had been hearing these reports from guys like Jack Lawrence or his own CBS reporters in the field, that was when Cronkite felt that he had been used by the authorities, that he felt that he's an old war reporter. He was a World War II combat correspondent. So he decided, I'm going to look at this myself, and actually went to Hue. And he came back and he said, you know what? The story is not the one I've been telling you. It is not what the officials say. This is what's really happening here. And it doesn't look like we can win this war.
Let me play a clip of Walter Cronkite giving his report on Vietnam. This is, again, 1968.
To say that we are closer to victory today is to believe, in the face of the evidence, the optimists who have been wrong in the past. To suggest we are on the edge of defeat is to yield to unreasonable pessimism. To say that we are mired in stalemate seems the only realistic, if unsatisfactory, conclusion. On the off chance the military and political analysts are right, in the next few months we must test the enemy's intentions in case this is indeed his last big gasp before negotiations. But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could. This is Walter Cronkite. Good night.
I'm trying to think, Mark, if there's any kind of equivalent to something like that, especially coming from a well-known and in many ways beloved journalist.
I don't know of any. I mean, because that was a unique moment in history where there were only three TV networks, you know, so most of America had turned on their TV sets at night and listened to either Walter Cronkite or Huntley and Brinkley, or I frankly forget who the ABC guy was. But for someone like Walter Cronkite, I should say, too, that the slam on those who were against the war was that they were hippies, they were communists, they were radicals, and no one was less radical or less hippie than Walter Cronkite. He was like America's uncle, and he was widely trusted. And that was, I think, a tremendously influential moment in American history.
You say with In Hue, both sides lost. I mean, both sides, I guess, claimed victory, but both sides lost. Mm-hmm. Was that a sort of a picture of the future of battles and warfare? What happened in Hue?
I think it's very often the case. And I think, you know, we as a country have been kind of nostalgic for the simplicity of something like World War II, where you battle an enemy state until it essentially, you know, unconditionally surrenders. That's victory, plain and simple. You occupy their country, you know, you run it, you won the war. Really, since then, starting with the Korean War and Vietnam, and now with all these smaller engagements all throughout the world, it's become a whole lot more complicated. It's very difficult to announce victory, or even, frankly, to define victory. And I think my problem with those who say, well, you know, the United States actually won the Tet Offensive or won the Battle of Hue is, well, how do you define victory? I mean, if the idea is to shore up the South Vietnamese people, this is a battle that killed 10,000 people in Hue and destroyed the city. 80% of the city was in ruins at the end of this. To me, I mean, you can't take away from the courage and the tenacity of the American Marines and soldiers who accomplished this. But in the end, you know, what have we accomplished? You know, the South Vietnamese people lost heart in their own Saigon government because they lack confidence in them. And in the United States, more and more people after this turned against the war. It became a huge movement. And it really, as I say in the book, I think it was at this point that we stopped as a country talking about victory. We started talking about how to get out of Vietnam.
I want to pick up on that. And that's Mark Bowden, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, talking about his new book, his big new book, I should say, called Hue 1968. We got folks that want to join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking about a battle that took place 49 years ago in Hue in what was then South Vietnam. And Mark Bowden's got a new book. It's called Hue 1968. And it's about what happened over those 24 days, part of this long, extensive, and bloody battle. Also, how this offensive changed Americans' view of the war, seeing it as unwinnable, also changed their view of their military and political leaders who claimed that victory was at hand, seeing them as largely dishonest. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get David from, looks like, Berlin, New Jersey to join us. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Burlington. My question is, well, it seems like Hue and the Tet Offensive, my bad, constituted America's first, I guess, culture shock into asymmetrical warfare. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the American war machine was so powerful that they needed to fight against the rules, different rules. And I'm curious what the Tet Offensive and Hue in particular taught the American armed forces about waging asymmetrical warfare.
Oh, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You want to take that, Mark?
Well, I think hopefully, first and foremost, it taught them to better respect their enemy. They had such a low estimate of the capability of the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese. I think it also illustrated how vital the public support for the Viet Cong was in the region around Hue, because there's no way you can assemble 10,000 troops without somebody noticing. And no one sounded an alarm to the South Vietnamese army or to the United States forces. So I think that, you know, the integration of the movement, of the Viet Cong movement, into the general population proved to be a far more important factor than the sheer number of forces and firepower that you could bring to the equation. And I do think that, you know, those lessons took a while but began to be learned.
Well, I'm thinking of Iraq. I mean, I'm thinking of the various wars and conflicts that we're involved in now. It seems that drones, although not entirely, but drones have replaced the sort of carpet bombing that we associate with the Vietnam War.
Yeah. I mean, I think the United States has become, to its credit, a lot more selective in targeting. And I think there's a tremendous sensitivity now, and this goes back to the surge in Iraq in, what was it, 2007, that had tremendous impact on our level of success there. And that was the recognition that, you know, when you kill civilians, when you turn them against you, and civilians are the goal. The civilians are the people you need more than any block or any roadway or any piece of real estate. You need those people to support what you're trying to do. If you don't have that support, you'll never succeed.
That's why we talk about nation building now.
Right. And nation building remains, you know, a test that the United States is not very good at. And frankly, you know, I think is something of a hopeless dream.
H.R. McMaster also was fought in the Vietnam War, wrote a famous book now called Dereliction of Duty. Hard to summarize it, but essentially saying the generals lost the war.
Yeah. General McMaster, who's now a national security advisor to President Trump, his book was really about how he felt that the high command of the American military were more interested in advancing their careers than they were in leveling with their political leadership, telling them that level of difficulty involved in Vietnam. And there were plenty of smart people around who could look at that problem and say, this is a no-win situation for the United States. We don't have there's no government in South Vietnam that's got popular support. They're corrupt. We can't count on them to fight. All these, you know, were things that signaled to military men that this was just not an achievable goal. But because it presented them with opportunities for promotion, for advancing their careers, I mean, soldiers look for wars. And here was a war beckoning. And so instead of leveling with the political leadership, they took the medals and promotions that were hanging just off the frame.
Do you have confidence that H.R. McMaster, who's obviously part of the Trump administration, that he can use his influence on the president?
I certainly hope so. I know he's kind of walking a delicate line. I know General McMaster, and I respect him both as a thinker and a soldier and a writer. But he's in a difficult spot, and you know, sometimes this president is pretty hard to defend. I hope that he stays there. To me, his presence, the presence of General Mattis at the defense, are two of the most reassuring things about this administration as far as I'm concerned.
Do you see any evidence of the president taking their advice?
I do. I think the Trump was elected saying he was going to tear up the nuclear agreement with Iran. He's backed away from that. He's, you know, tweeted about North Korea and his desire to prevent Kim Jong-un from building nuclear weapons. But the alternatives, the military alternatives, are pretty bleak in stopping him. And I think without the counsel of people like Mattis and McMaster, who will say, wait a minute, you know, what exactly are our options here and what will they cost? I think so far he hasn't done anything rash.
You have a piece in The Atlantic, actually, about how to deal with North Korea, laying out the four options, as you say, all of them bad.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think this is going to end?
I think inevitably it's going to end with Kim Jong-un having a nuclear-tipped ICBM. And I don't see any way of preventing that from happening short of initiating a conflict that could kill millions of people, that could become literally one of the worst catastrophes in human history. So since, you know, there really are no military ways that we can prevent him, we would have to depend on China leaning on North Korea, which up until now they've proved unwilling to do.
You describe in some vivid detail about just all the military along the DMZ that is, I guess, largely aimed at South Korea.
Sure. I mean, within hours of any kind of offensive against North Korea, they could effectively level Seoul, a city of about 26 million people. And that's just with conventional arms.
Right.
We know they have biological weapons and chemical weapons and nuclear weapons. So not only is Seoul at immediate risk, so are 30,000 American troops who are based in South Korea. You know, it seems to me in a nuclear situation or in a standoff like this, the goal is to prevent conflict from happening. And that frankly, is the strategy of North Korea, and it's going to continue to work.
Is Kim Jong-un, from your perspective, is he crazy?
No, he is the head of a crazy regime. But he is exactly the sort of person who you would expect that regime to produce. I mean, he cannot be, it seems to me, other than what he is. And, you know, as dictators go, I mean, he's cruel and vicious, but these are qualities that have enabled dictators to hold on to power for a long time.
Mark Bowden, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We were just talking about a piece he has in The Atlantic about North Korea. We've been spending the most of the hour talking about his new book called Hue 1968. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I have some comments here and a couple of calls as well. You write in this book that the people of Vietnam, now one country, they don't hate us.
No. You know,
does that surprise you?
It has to be surprising. It shouldn't be, I guess, just by virtue of the fact that Americans have been traveling there freely for the past 10, 15 years. And we don't read stories of Americans being harassed or attacked. In my experience, people were warm and friendly and hospitable. The food was fantastic. And there is no evidence anywhere of hostility which is frankly surprising given that a million Vietnamese were killed in the war against the United States. I guess it does a lot that they won the war. So they don't have, they don't seem to have hard feelings.
And what does Hue look like?
Hue is largely rebuilt. The southern half of the city, the modern part, is bustling and thriving. There are cranes and tall buildings going up everywhere. There's, tremendous. The Vietnamese government has loosened up private enterprise and land ownership. So there's just a bustling industry wherever you go. Mm-hmm. The same is true inside the Citadel, which is the northern part of the city. But you can still see, the holes in the walls and the damage done by the shelling and fighting mm-hmm. 50 years ago.
In fact, you said about 80% of the city was destroyed.
Damaged or destroyed.
Damaged
yeah.
or destroyed.
And I think 80% of the population was homeless at the end of the battle.
Let me play one more clip. And this is 1968. It's funny. I'd sort of lost track of this. President Johnson announcing that he was not going to run for re-election. Let's give it a listen.
With America's future under challenge right here at home, with our hopes and the world's hopes for peace and the balance every day, I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office, the presidency of your country. Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
That's an extraordinary moment. I remember it well. Can we say that Johnson was one of the casualties of that war?
I think he was. I think he had been disillusioned by the Tet Offensive, just as many other Americans had. He never stopped, advocating for, America standing up for South Vietnam. He didn't abandon the cause, but he did, I think, tire of carrying the burden. And after that speech, he devoted the remaining months of his presidency to trying to maneuver Hanoi into negotiations. I think his fondest hope was that he'd be able to negotiate an end to the war before his successor took mm-hmm. office.
And the war went on till what, 75?
1975. Remember, Richard Nixon one election. I thought after Johnson bowed out in 1968 that Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, would be president because he had tremendous popular support and there was growing anti-war sentiment. And then, of course, Kennedy was assassinated in June of that year. And Richard Nixon ran not on a platform promising to win the war, but with a, quote, secret plan to end the war in Vietnam, which turned out to be bombing Cambodia and Laos and basically waging, you know, a fruitless war for another 6 or 7 years.
Which begat Pol Pot and all of that, right?
Right, and Watergate and lots of things.
Let me get Frank from, this is our history, folks. Let me get Frank from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Frank, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks, Marty, for taking the call.
Sure.
I believe that the war in Vietnam, like most wars outside of World War One and Two, because of the nature and the vastness of those wars and the decidedly evil forces playing out in those wars, is another version of Wag the Dog,
right,
where we distract ourselves in Western nations, including the United States, to generate an economy that's based on the blood of human beings.
Well, Frank,
and it is part of the fog of war.
Do you see it that way? Do you see Vietnam as a wag the dog situation, Mark Bowden?
No, I don't. I do believe that the United States went into Vietnam on the strength of, well, you remember John F. Kennedy's inaugural address, we'll bear any burden, pay any price. And there was this overriding theory of communist monolith spreading all over the world. And the United States represented the free world and needed to defend democracy wherever there was this communist threat. And I think Vietnam, at least in the beginning, you know, fit that mold. I do believe that Kennedy and the people around him had begun to face up more to the peculiarities and the realities of Southeast Asia, that in fact it didn't fit this mold before Kennedy was killed. Johnson, I think, was so felt so duty-bound to shoulder all of the Kennedy agenda that he didn't question Vietnam. He just, you know, continued to build on it.
Let me read an email from Jackie. How can revealing this narrative in fact about Vietnam inform us about the denials, lies of military interventions today, perhaps more important, the lack of protests on the current ongoing interventions. But Jackie's raising questions about what we now call fake news. Mm-hmm. Was fake news, I won't say born in Vietnam, but fine-tuned?
Well, I think it's fairly clear. I mean, certainly I can speak with authority about the Battle of Hue that the fake news was coming from official sources. I don't think it's fair to say that the government is always lying or that the military is always lying. I do think that a healthy, skeptical journalism is essential in a democracy. Unfortunately, with the decline of major journalistic institutions, with the sort of fragmenting of journalism, with the rise of so-called journalistic institutions, which are essentially vehicles of propaganda, that it's become increasingly difficult for citizens to trust information and to know where to go to get trustworthy information. And I think that's, you know, frankly, one of the biggest problems we face as a country.
The fact that we don't know who to trust or how to trust the information that comes our way?
Yes. I mean, on one hand, the breakdown of journalistic institutions is a good thing because it democratizes the spread of information. Frankly, anybody with a cell phone can broadcast or publish anything they want. The downside to that is you get this cacophony of perspectives and reports. And even a very well-meaning and intelligent, informed person has a hard time figuring out what to trust. Hmm. And I think that each of us has developed our own strategies for that, but it's a challenge.
Mark Bowden, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure, Marty.
And his book is called Hue 1968. I should add, he's speaking at the Free Library of Philadelphia. That's on July 11th at 7:30. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. In fact, we took some pictures before the show. We will load them up so you can see what we look like. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. And the show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.